All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. How's it going? My guest today is Michael K. Williams. Yeah, fucking Michael K. Williams. Omar from The Wire. Yeah, Omar from The Wire is here. You also know him from Boardwalk Empire, The Night Of. He's in the HBO movie, Bessie, with Queen Latifah. He's on this, the other one, the Lovecraft show. You know him, man. It's the dude with the scar on his face. Big fan of his. And he's in this new film, Body Brokers. And I also talked to Melissa Leo on Monday about the movie as well a bit. And it's one of these small movies. It's not going to get a lot of advertising money spent on it. And there's not going to be a lot of free publicity on it. But it's worth seeing. And it's worth hearing these people who are in it. And I hopefully can get to talk to the director as well. But this movie is about the rehab racket. It's about the drug rehab racket on all levels. It doesn't pull any punches. It's got a little bit of snark to it in terms of the narration, which is seems to be sort of a thing now. Kind of like that the We Care a Lot movie. But the nuts and bolts of it are pretty disturbing. Because there are people given the opportunity, given the window, you know, given, you know, just the room to do it, will be corrupt, morally bankrupt, greedy, evil fucks. Almost everybody is an opportunist. Almost everybody is selfish. And when a system breaks down as thoroughly as the system has broken down here over the last 4 years, even people who think they're good, when they see a window of opportunity to do something a little off or way off, will take it if they can rationalize the action. Anyways, that's another tangent. Maybe I could talk about that because I got a little something stuck in my craw. I don't know. Are there really innately sort of selfless or, you know, empathetic people? Are most people selfish fucking people? I tend to think so. Like, I'm a cranky bastard. I'm defensive. You know, I seem to be kind of self-centered. But, you know, I spend a lot of time in my head. I spend a lot of time, even when it's not a plague, even when I'm not alone, I find I spend a lot of time in my head. But if you get me out of my head because you need help, if you call me up and you need something and you're a friend or somebody I know and I know you're not trying to take advantage of me, I'll fucking step up. I mean, I'm not saying I'm the guy that's going to run into the burning building to pull the people out or the doggies or the kitties. But, you know, when the guy comes down with the doggies or the kitties or the people, I'll walk him to the ambulance. I'll put a blanket around him and walk him to where they need to go to sit down or perhaps, give them a bottle of water, you know. I don't know if I'm the guy that's going to step in between a couple of guys fighting, but I'll hang around and say, hey, come on, chill. Look, I'm no saint. But my point is, are there good people? Are there just genuinely good people? Like, you think about all these service, these healthcare people, they're tremendously good people. It's their job, but they do the job of helping. They do the job of healing. Those people are altruistic and necessary. And thank God they exist. There are people that put their lives on the line for other people. And yeah, obviously, everyone's got their problems. But I'm saying I think most people are out for themselves. And I don't think that's just some part of capitalism. I think there seems to be a few different types of people. There's desperate people that need to survive. So they're going to do what's necessary to survive. They have to. And hopefully it doesn't kill them or others. Then there's people that are just shamelessly fucking self-serving. Like, fuck you. I want mine. I get mine. I'll do whatever I have to do to get mine. It doesn't even have to be about survival. Just, you know, fuck you. Get out of my way. I'm taking it. And then there's people that think they're good Yet they do the same thing. What am I beating around the bush about? I finally know somebody. Look, I'm sure there's plenty of, you know, people I know, rich people, people of in positions of power that have jumped the line to get the vaccine. And the real question is, like, if you had the opportunity, if I had the opportunity, you know, would I go get the vaccine? Probably. Am I seeking that opportunity out? No. If someone said to me, like, dude, I got some vaccine in my truck. Come here. Do you want vaccine? $50. I'll shoot you up right now. We can knock it out, dude. $50. I got a cooler in the truck. I probably wouldn't do that. You know, am I going to hang around a parking lot of a clinic for leftover ones? No. It's happening. So I'm going to wait till my healthcare provider, or to my Walgreens, makes it available to me. It's a drag. And I know there are line jumpers, but the truth is that even if you think you're a good person, where's the virtue in waiting your turn if you don't have to? Right? I mean, if you had the choice, or if you wanted to make it your goal, like, I'm tired of this shit. I'm going to do whatever I got to do to go find me a fucking shot, a vaccine on the level, on the up and up. But knowing that it really isn't on the up and up because, you know, it's not your turn. What do the virtuous get? You know, last in line, COVID. They could die, I guess. But they'll die knowing that they didn't fucking jump the line. But there's no difference between the good people who think they're good and do the shitty thing and the people that are shamelessly shitty. The only difference between those people is the good people pay lip service to feeling bad about it or guilty, but they still did the same thing. You don't feel bad. Just be honest. I mean, people who jump lines or cheat or steal, but they're, you know, innately good people that have somehow rationalized their behavior primarily because they worked hard to figure out how to do it, or they took advantage of their place in the world to get special treatment. And they're like, yeah, I feel a little guilty. No, you don't. You don't feel bad. You feel glad. Just shut up. Don't tell anybody if you cheated or if you jumped the line. Just keep it to yourself, or just say, fuck you. I figured it out and I got it. That's what you did. That's who you are. You're not like, oh, you know, I probably shouldn't have, but, you know, I just, shut up. You fucking put your mind to it and you figured out a way to jump the line or get it. But don't play games. Don't like, you know, I feel bad. No, you don't. People are selfish. It's like, what do you feel like? Hey, you know, it's like, I'm sorry I started that fire, you know, but you know, we had a nice, it was a nice picnic. I mean, I feel bad about the fire that burned all those land and killed those horses, but you know, those were good hot dogs. Hey, it's really sad, man, that, you know, the neighbor's house burnt down because of our barbecue, but we had a good time, and, you know, I don't really know them, and, you know, they're gone now. I mean, it's sad, but I feel bad about it. But, you know, we had a nice cookout. Spare me. Why am I so worked up? I know why. Because I'm not trying to cheat to get my fucking vaccine, and I want it so I can feel better. I'm tired of it too. But this is what waiting online sounds like. Fuck these people. Cut the fuck. What about me? Come here, buddy. I got a cooler in the truck. I'm sitting on 4 Moderna. You like Moderna? You want the Pfizer? I got the Pfizer. Whatever you want, buddy. Just come over to the truck, man. I got it in the cooler. You want Pfizer? Got the J&J coming next week. What do you need, bro? $100. You got $200 cash? I'll lay the Moderna on you right now. I'll give you the second shot. You put it in your freezer. Just keep it for yourself. I'll give you the works. I'll give you everything. I'll give you the full kit. $200. Come on, man. I got it in the truck. You want the Fize? I got the Fize. You want the Fize? You want the Moderna? Fize, one shot will work. 2 shots guaranteed. J&J, that shit's going for a little more, a little pricier. $500, man. I got it right now. You want it? Want the rig? I'll give you the full works. $500 for J&J. So this movie, Body Brokers, is a good movie. It's available to buy or rent on demand on platforms like iTunes, Prime Video, and more. Body Brokers is the name of the movie. Michael K. Williams is my guest. You also know him as Omar from The Wire. That was the big breakout. Boardwalk Empire, Lovecraft Country, The Night of, Bessie. He was in Bessie, HBO. But anyways, I was nervous because I didn't know what he would be like. But man, we had a nice time and we had a nice chat. This is me talking to the amazing Michael K. Williams. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. Where are you at right now?
I'm in New York, man, Brooklyn, BK.
Is the snow still there?
Yeah, you know, some snow on the ground. It's winter, so we do here, you know what I mean?
I know. I lived there for a long time. I lived on the Lower East Side and over on 16th Street. I got no seasons out here. Yeah.
Are you in Cali now?
I'm in California, and it's just a little chilly. That's our winter. It's a little chilly.
Yeah.
not too bad. There's some part about having nothing to do that's not that terrible.
Man, then come on with it. You better talk that talk.
I mean, I know it's like it gets a little crazy, but on another level, it's like, hey, if nobody else is doing anything, fuck it. I'm okay.
You're going to have to be. What's because the alternative sucks. You know what I mean?
It's like, bad.
You're going to have to be okay, man, and get some type of grounding.
Did you get it or no?
You know, I got a little scare. Someone in my family, they went down, they had to be hospitalized, and I was in contact with them. I quarantined for the 14 days.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a point where, you know, I was like, I don't smell nothing. And, you know, and the taste got a little, you know, I was like, damn, I you know, because I cook, right? So I made a pot of curry. And I was like, damn, now I know I could taste my curry. And I was like, okay, maybe I am. So I had some symptoms, but, you know, grace to God, man, I didn't have to be hospitalized. No temperatures, no problems breathing. It's when I just quarantined. Yeah.
So you did, you tested, you got it. You got it. And you just got a minor.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. You got lucky. It's fucking crazy, man.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I consider myself blessed today, man. You know, one, I got good genes, you know, I came from really good genes physically. And, you know, over the summer, man, you know, like you spoke about with everybody else ain't doing nothing. So I had to find something to do because nothing for me is not an option. You know, I don't mind double workshop. I'm
sure.
That dude.
Yeah.
So, you know, I found physical fitness this summer, but not for the sake of muscles. You know, I got real familiar with cardio and calisthenics and stretching and breathing. Yeah. Simple shit. And I truly believe, man, that because I put that as in my program and my daily routine, that it gave me a leg to stand on to fight that motherfucker back a little bit, that shit, and it didn't knock me down. I mean, I'm no doctor. That's just my little take on it. That's what I chose to believe, that, you know, we are so conditioned to run from this thing that, you know, I think sometimes we need to also remember that we have everything in our bodies to kind of, to at least arm it to fight back. Like, we got a gun in our body. It's called an immune system. And we put some bullets in that motherfucker. we might just slay the giant. We don't know until we fight back. So that's, you know, I just, that's where I'm at with it. Yeah. Hold on 1 second. Don't hang up. Hold on 1 second.
I'm not going to hang up.
I had my little lunch on the stove, and I smelled this. Let me turn this shit off. All right, so what's up, man? Talk to me, Mark.
Well, I mean, I've been doing that too. Do you meditate?
Yeah. Not as much as I used to. I'm one of those people like, damn, you know, meditating is so hard. I'm like, damn, Mike, you mean sitting down, not saying shit, turning up your brain, closing your eyes. That's hard? Like, really?
You got to do it first thing. It's only hard if you've been doing other shit. If you had a bunch of coffee, you've already eaten. You know what I mean? Whatever. You've already on the computer, and then all of a sudden, I got to sit down and shut it off. Right when you get out of bed, just do it. That's what I've been doing. I just started a couple months ago.
You know what? I received that, brother. Thank you. That's the trick. Because, you know, I wait till I, you know, by the time I remember to do it, I've already done a few things in the morning.
Yeah. And your brain's on fire.
That's what the trick. Do it first thing in the morning before my feet even leave the bed.
Right. I got the mat on the floor. I got, you know, like I just see it on the floor, and I get up and I do a yoga a little bit. And then I sit with the guy, the English guy on the app, the Headspace app. And he talks me through it. He's annoying, but, you know, talks me through it.
You know what? I'm going to take that suggestion, bro. I'm like, the next time I see you, I'm going to be like, thank you. And this is what I've been. You gave me two things. One, do it first thing in the morning. And I got a yoga mat here that I never use. But if I lay it out in my room, in my bedroom by my bed, and if I see it, it'll jar my memory. That's a great idea, man. I'm going to try that shit, bro.
Just get up and do it. Like, I also, you know, I'm a big fan. And I watched the new movie, The Body Brokers. And I, you know, look, I'm a sober dude, you know, and I know that world a little bit. And then, you know, as it reveals itself, it's sort of like it's insane and heartbreaking and informative. I really liked the movie, and I thought that you did a great job with it, man.
Oh, man, thank you. You know, and first of all, this was a passion project for me, because I share your story. You know, I'm in the club as well too.
Really? Yeah.
Yes, sir. You know, and you know, anybody that's heard me speak before, I'm not shy about it. You know, relapse is a part
me
of
neither.
my story, and you know, but I'm living good today. You know, I guess all we got is today. But this film, you know, institutions, and death, right?
Yeah, right.
So, I've had my fair share of institutions. I, you know, thank God I haven't gone to jail yet, and obviously I'm still here. But I've had my fair share with institutions. And, you know, I feel what you said was this film, the narrative of this film was extremely disturbing, extremely disturbing. And I was like, what do we do with that? Like, that's, are you kidding me?
So when you first read the script by John Swab, is that his name?
Yeah, John Swab, man. Great guy. He's the writer and the director.
Yeah, because I know guys that work in that industry, but he, my buddy Mike, he came over yesterday to talk a little bit because I told him about the movie, and he's like, when he works with in rehabs, and he had to quit two jobs, you know, because they were corrupt and he didn't feel comfortable, right? So my thing was, you know, when you read that script as a sober guy, you know, you must have realized, like, you know, I got to do this. People have to know this, right? But then the character, too, like that character, he's not only a guy who's not quite sober and playing that part, but it's a movie about people rationalizing, you know, compartmentalizing things that makes them kind of evil, right?
Yes. I mean, you hit it right on the head. As you and I, we both know, being sober doesn't take away the craziness. You know, there's a lot of crazy motherfuckers in this program, you know, me included. Right?
I call them demons in exile.
There you go. You know what I'm saying? and to me, Wood was a perfect example of that.
Yeah. I'm sober, but I can still do cocaine.
You know, but and even I'm sober, but I can still, you know, use people.
Right.
You know, I'm selling drugs.
Yeah.
You know, that was even more profound, you know, because for me, this film, it spoke about the insanity. And like, people think that Well, I assume that sometimes people think that drugs are the problem. Drugs are the symptom of a of the problem. You know, once we put the drugs down, that's when the work begins. We got to clean up this house, all this garbage, right? Yeah. And so, because it manifests in other ways in our life, poor decision making, you know, and poor characteristic traits, right? And so Wood was a perfect example and an opportunity for me to show that side of what a recovering addict looks like. It's not all roses and once you put the drug down, it's happily ever after and life is going to be great. No, there's a lot of stinking thinking that we need to get rid of and bad habits and bad thought processes. And Wood is an example of that. But I'll tell you, the redeeming moment for me with Wood
in the car,
when the car scene, and when he apologized, he made amends, man. And that was that redeeming quality in him that made me fall in love with the character on a whole nother level.
That acting to where, you know, you drop into the heart of that guy that's actually tormented and not the guy that justifies his behavior. That was a great turn there. And you can feel like those choices, man.
Man, I just want to take this time to also say, I wasn't in that scene alone, obviously. Man, I just got to tell you, Jack Kilmer, what he bought, the honesty, the vulnerability that he bought to that character, man.
Yeah.
Him and Alice, they are like, I'm obsessed with them. I can't take my eyes off of them, man, in this film. But what Jack bought in that scene in that car, you know, that level of loyalty that he had, that the way he looked up, he brought so much to the dynamic, man. I couldn't have reached where I needed to be had it not been for what he brought to the table.
That's interesting. He was great. And it was definitely that contrast of, like, you know, that moment where he says, like, you know, people have been talking to me like that my whole life. You know,
and you realize, come on, bro. Come on, bro. Validation. He saw Wood. It was like, that was like a meeting in the car right there. Yeah,
right.
Man, that scene it meant a lot to me. And he brought us so much to it, bro. Him as with his instrument, he brought so much to the character. He made it very easy for me.
Yeah.
Very easy. Yeah, man.
Well, I got a question because I get asked it too. Because when I did the show Glow, my character does blow, you know, and I've been sober, you know, 22 years something. And people always ask me, like, was that hard? And I'm like, I don't know. I didn't even think about it. What was it like for you to be around drugs?
You know, in the film, Body Brokers, ironically, Wood didn't trigger me because of the decision that I made as to where he was in his recovery when he was sniffing that coke at that pool party.
Yeah.
I'll tell you who did trip me the fuck up was Ooh. Freddie Knight on the night of when he was sniffing dope and the reasons why, the escapism. That was very familiar to my journey, to my struggle with this disease, man.
Oh, when you were in jail?
Yeah, it's called the night of. And
yeah, no, I saw it.
Name was Freddie.
Yeah, yeah.
Freddie Knight triggered the hell out of me, man. He woke up, he was rubbing that genie bottle like a motherfucker. I was like, no, get back in. I don't know. Wood that night, you know, I believed Wood when he said, man, it was more about, you know, the chicks being in the moment. I don't think that he was in a relapse state of mind, although, you know, technically he did get high.
Right.
I don't think that it was that. I think he was just in the moment. And because he said it, you know, the chicks, these dumb chicks bought this shit over here, blah, 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 blah. You know, whatever. You know, Freddie was in a different space. That, you know, I don't know how to do drugs recreation in just for the moment. I know how to numb the pain.
He did it to cope.
Cope. That's what I did it for. And that tripped me up.
Right, man. So, like, when did you start? Where do you think it started with you? Where'd you grow up?
Oh, I grew up in Brooklyn, man. I grew up in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, in a little project called the Vandeveer. Vanderbilt States. And, you know, like I said, it ain't about the drug. The drug is a symptom of the problem. But I started coping very early. And, you know, I became an actor very early. I would say by the age 9, I was completely addicted to fantasy. Like, nothing about my life did I want, you know. So,
like how, you know, like how did that manifest itself? Like, what kind of fantasies you, what were you into?
I mean, being something I wasn't, yeah. You know, like, for instance, my community, you know, is a Western and Caribbean community heavily that, you know, that's, you know, we call the Nostrand Avenue, Little Haiti. And on
from is that where your folks are from?
No, my mother's from the Bahamas, actually. Oh, okay. And my father is from the South, which is, so you had half of the community that was West Indian Caribbean, and then you had the other half that was Black American. Yeah. And there was a clash of cultures, like in the mid to late 70s to the 80s. And you had to pick one. You were either a lazy welfare recipient Yankee, yeah, or you were a high water wearing, banana boat driving coconut.
Yeah.
Those were your options. And my mother being from the Caribbean and my father being from the South, you know, and me having a huge need to fit in,
yeah,
right? And this low self-esteem, I you know, I started, like, you know, I lost my identity very quickly, very young, trying to fit in, to be liked, to be accepted, to go under the radar so nobody would. I didn't want to ever be singled out. And
yeah.
So, you know, the disconnect from getting to know who Michael was,
yeah,
that started at a very early age, and the ability to chameleon myself,
yeah,
to fit whatever I thought you needed to see to get in with you,
yeah,
that also started very early. So that's what I mean when I say I got addicted to fantasy very quick.
Well, you get addicted young. To, like, I have that problem too. Like, you know, by the end of this conversation, I'll probably be talking exactly like you. I just have that thing where I feel like I'm a whole person, but, you know, when I get around stronger personalities, you just kind of like, I'll just live in that guy's skin for a while.
Yeah. Welcome to my, and of course I became an actor, right? Like, great, great job for someone like me. But, you know, I nearly, you know, like, drove myself crazy, man. But, you know, again, Wood was an opportunity to explore all those different things, you know, because I believe in some form of fashion, we're all addicts, you know.
Yeah, it's the economy of this country is built on it.
Thank you.
It requires
you, which
us.
Which is what the movie talks. It requires us. Which is what the film talks about.
Yeah. You
know, it manifests in food.
Yeah.
Food disorders, sexual disorders, shopping, yeah, disorders, relationship with it, you know, being codependent. You know, yeah, being emotionally manipulative. That shit seeps out in so many different
characteristic
human personality.
That's my daily schedule you just read off.
Yeah, I would love to hear you speak one day, bro. Real talk.
So you like to cook. You're cooking back there. Did you grow, yeah, up like... Because I always assume that, you know, people from the Caribbean, I always think about food. You know, like... So it must have been... At least you had an interesting confluence of culture there in the food department, huh?
Absolutely, you know, and I'm a foodie, you know. I don't eat to live; I live to I live to eat. You,
yeah,
feel me?
And yeah.
I love everything about food, not just the eating process. I love the preparation, like, you know. You know, in my mind, Rachel Ray is like one of my best fucking friends. You know, I'll sit here and I'll watch a segment, and she, you know, the way, you know, and butter.
Yeah.
Put some of that. Oh, look at that.
You know, yeah,
she just,
yeah,
makes my mouth water when she cooks. I share her passion for food. It's like, it's bananas. And then what I'll do is, you know, I'll challenge myself. I'll, like, you know, I won't go to the website and look at the recipe.
Yeah.
I could look at what she's doing that day. Now I know the basics of what she has a basic, like, template that she works from, you know, garlic, olive oil, a little salt and pepper, the basic,
yeah,
you know. There's some, and I, so we got the same foundation, and I just kind of, you know, I may put a little twist on it or change something up here. Or I may even fuck it up. Who knows? But I just love the prepping of food. I love, you know, trying new things. And Lord, do I love feeding people. I love when call people over, man, let's break bread, man, my people, my family, my friends.
Right, and then you serve everybody, and then you have that minute where you're like, so hey, how how good am I? I'm great, right? It's great, right? Yeah. I did that. Pretty fucking good, right?
I just love to see people eat, man.
Me too. You know. I do, and also it's a great way to occupy the time, man. I've been smoking fish. I'm a Jew, so I've been trying to figure out how to smoke the fish like the old Jews. And I got this smoker out there, so I'm fucking prepping, I'm brining, I'm smoking fish. Yesterday, I spent an hour trying to figure out how to make perfect baba ganoush. And then, like, you know, you spend like 3 hours doing this shit. Like, you know, smoking fish takes hours. And then I'll eat it in 30 seconds. Like, I don't give a fuck. I'll put hours into prep, and then I'll just plow through it. If I'm alone and I make something, I'll eat it in 25 seconds.
You're two for two. The yoga mat and doing meditating in the morning. I'm going to find out how to smoke some fucking fish.
You got a smoker?
I'm going to get one because I know I've heard about this process before. I'm going to get the smoker, and I'm going to go to air fryer. Those are two things I want to get. But the smoker,
I heard about the air fryer. Everyone's talking about the air fryer.
They
gave it to me. The Traeger grill, they gave me the smoker, the wood pellets. You got a yard to put it in?
Yeah, I got a little outdoor space. Yeah.
Yeah, throw it up there. I mean, I've been smoking the fish, and like I love to cook, and I'll do it by myself. Keeps me sane. It's the same thing talking about with the, you know, I just got to be careful. Like I got, like if I get off on, like I made a pie, like I made, like if I eat, if I fucking make a pie, dude, I'm fucked for weeks. You know, then I'm making cakes.
Talk about putting the pie in the pie hole, huh?
Yeah.
I stay away from it. Yeah. My family, we were more pecan pie.
Oh, pecan shit. Pie. Have you ever made that?
Those are the. Never, but I will eat about three pies by myself. I promise you that.
It's the best.
Or sweet potato.
Yeah.
Or put that in front of me.
I eat sweet potatoes all the time. I just have them for a snack. That's what I do. And I drink a pot of coffee. This is how I manage my addiction, Mike. And I fucking, you know, just like if there's ever a spare minute, I'm thinking about, all right, what can I eat? What do we got?
Ain't nothing. Listen, bro, you ain't hurt nobody. I love food, you know what I mean? And you know, I try to keep it, you know, I'm not a health nut in the sense where, you know, I don't eat this, I don't eat that.
Yeah.
I don't care if I want a good juicy, greasy cheeseburger, that's what I'm going to eat. You know, I'm not doing that every day. I'm going to definitely make sure I use it in my regimen. But,
yeah, it's good. Yeah, enjoy yourself. Try to enjoy yourself.
It's the alternative. We got to enjoy life, man. We got to enjoy it.
Yeah. I don't think about the other shit at all anymore. So when did you, like, start really doing the acting? I mean, when did you start doing it? Like, when did you decide it was your life? I mean, was it one of those things where you're like, you got to save your life with something?
You know, The Wire. You know, so before The Wire, you know, I used to be a background dancer, you know, mostly house acts, you know, Crystal Waters, Technotronics, things like that.
You were a dancer? Like that.
Yeah, man, I danced for like 7 years, man.
And self-taught?
Then, yeah, you know, street dancer. You know, I used to watch the Janet Jackson videos. That's how I learned how to catch choreography. Then I started going public, and I would try to do the dance. And they'd be like, you're going the wrong way. Because I would learn off the freaking TV, right?
That's funny. So it's a Rachel Ray and Janet Jackson. These are the keys to your existence.
You're damn right. So around in 1998, well, my first film I ever did was a film called Bullet. Tupac Shakur, the late, great Tupac Shakur, he had saw a picture, a Polaroid of me, and he saw that I had this scar on my face. And he was like, oh, he told Julian Temple, the director, let's find this guy and audition him. And that was the first thing I'd ever done.
The scar got you the job.
Basically. Yes, it did.
What was that fight about that got you that scar?
Real simple, in a couple of sentences. 25th birthday, pissy drunk, ballroom brawl. Nothing special. And I, you know, except the fact that I almost lost my life that night. But, there was a situation. Well, I technically I started it. You know, I was drunk. I had the liquid courage in me, and I saw a situation with someone that I had known at the time.
Yeah.
And it had nothing to do with me. And I stuck my nose in someone else's business. But in my drunk mind, I was being loyal. Like, you know, I'm not going to watch you get jumped. So, yeah. And I was, you know, and so I was, you know, puffing my chest out due to the alcohol. And I was in that zone. And when that situation de-escalated, those dudes that were having a confrontation with the person that I knew, they turned their attention on me, and the rest is history. So the second thing that I did was this movie called Mugshot, you know, and it was with Matt Mahern from New York City. And, you know, it was an independent film, but I went from being just like a Tupac's little brother to my second thing was a lead role in this independent film.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was starting to get a little, you know, like starting to think this could happen. And then, you know, Dick Wolf, he had all of his projects, you know, New York Undercover,
yeah,
Law and Orders. That was essential for young New York City actors at the time. And I started booking those things. And then the phone just went dead. 1999 rolls around.
With the Dick Wolf stuff, though, did you feel like you were being typecast?
Hell no. I still to this day don't acknowledge typecast. Newsflash, you know, I don't get to assimilate into other cultures very much. You know, I'm a black man and I tell the black experience, right?
Yeah.
And,
yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm from the hood.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact I have a front seat view with how people end up in the situations that they end up. No one wakes up one morning and says, I got it. I'm going to be a successful, you know, a crack dealer on the corner. Or I'm going to be a successful thug that robs people. Or I'm going to be a successful thing. No one wakes up and says, I'm going to be a successful anything that gets them in jail.
Right.
They do that out of a series, out of a desperation and a feeling that they have no other options. Right. And I've watched that happen so many times, the people that I call my brothers, my family members in my community. And when I started becoming an actor and people were in Hollywood was looking to me to portray these stories, I immediately wore that as a badge of honor.
Right.
Cause I was like, this is my community. These are my people. I know these people. I'm gonna do everything possible to make sure that people who don't know this lifestyle, don't know this community, will leave from the story feeling empathy and having some sort of compassion and some sort of understanding. Not saying you got to agree, but those three things, I made it my responsibility to leave the audience with those three things.
Well, that's interesting. So your point of view was that, like, you know, instead of looking at me as somebody who is pigeonholed by this type of role, you say, like, yeah, but these are real people who I know, and this is part of the experience, and I'm going to depict it with honesty and authenticity, you know, and these characters are going to be alive. This isn't, I'm not playing a caricature. This isn't a puppet here, you know, so you won't. So I imagine that when you look at a script, you think in terms of, like, you know, how deep is this fucker? You know, like, is this a real thing, or are you selling this guy short?
I don't have to even wonder. I can read the first 20 pages and know you bullshitting as a writer.
Right.
I don't have to even, it's nothing to wonder about. What I go in the script looking for is, how do I identify? That's what I go looking for. Okay, Mike, how do you identify with this character? Because I know if you're really saying you writing a story about my community, I'm going to find somewhere along this man's life, I'm going to have a parallel with him. So I go in looking for that. And I can tell you you don't know what the fuck you're talking about within the first 20 pages.
And where'd you learn the craft? Where'd you study the acting?
I was, again, New York City, man. No city like in the world.
Yeah.
And I was blessed to be introduced to the off-Broadway theater world of New York City. My first play that I did was at a theater on the Lower East Side called the La Mama.
I know that place.
Theater under Ellen Stewart. I was actually, God bless her soul, man. I was the last play that she produced and directed and wrote. I was in that. It was a city opera, and it was called Tancredi and Armenia. And it was about the war of the cultures in that part of the world, Middle East. And then I studied there for about a year or two. And then I left and went to Harlem And I studied under the late, great Tunde Samuels, and he worked out of the National Black Theater, as we call it, NBT. And there was a young writer, a director. Her name is Judy Shepherd King. And she had written this play called Endangered Species. And I got a part in that. And then thirdly, my good friend and brother, Ray Thomas, who I owe a lot to, he's from Philadelphia. Shout out to Philly. And he brought his mentor and his theater company to New York City. Every Saturday, these men would either get on the train or they would pile up in cars and they would come to New York every Saturday and they would teach. And Mel Williams, he's the director of the company, and it's called Theater for a New Generation. And every Saturday, man, we would come and we would have class either at the Producers Club or any little black box in New York City, man. And we would from 12 to 3, we would have a theater class. And then, you know, it would be a 10-week course that he would do. And then around the fourth or fifth week, he would start giving out. He would break us up into groups, into partners, and he would give us scenes from a classic plays like Streetcar Named Desire, Ceremonies and Dark Old Men. He has a litany of classic plays. He would take scenes and he would give us the different groups scenes. And at the end of the 10th week, the last 2 weeks, he put us on stage. We would put up and he called it the theater night would be called the Night of Scenes. And we'd sell tickets and get people to come. And I did that for years, man. And I took that into the audition process, man, in Hollywood. And I started to book. But then, like I was saying earlier, man, the phones went dead like around 99.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get a gig. And so, you know, my mom, God bless her, man, she retired and she decided that, you know, sitting down wasn't for her. And she opened up a daycare in the projects where we live. And by 2001, she was blossoming. Like, you know, 70-year-old woman with no education, like you know, really doing it. And so,
what, the daycare center got popular?
It got popular, man. And at her highlight, the kids, we took them from 1 to 5 years old. So when they left us, they went to first grade. The kids that were leaving our daycare were performing academically on such a high rate. We were the number one in the community in Flatbush.
Teaching?
No. You know, after, like I was saying, when I couldn't get, when I start, I stopped booking.
Yeah.
And in 2000, my mom took all of us to the Bahamas, where she's from, because, you know, that was the end of the world. The 2K was coming.
Yeah.
The end of the world. The sky's going to fall. You know, yeah. And my mom was like, yo, we going out. I want all my family together. We going home and we going to rock out. And so at the New Year's dinner party, she goes, she said she offered me a job at the daycare because, you know, I was borrowing money to pay my rent from her, you know, every friggin' month. And she said, you know, might as well come work for me. You know, I'm paying your rent. You might as well earn the money. So I was like, yeah, Ma, you know, not a bad idea. Things could be a lot worse. We got a family business in the community. Why not? So I did that for all of 2000. And then into 2001, she gave me a desk and I coined myself her administrative assistant because she old school. She had everything on in ledger books. So, you know, I computerized everything for, you know, yada, yada, yada.
So
she gave me something to do. So I did that all of 2000 and then all of 2001. And as you know, by September, 9/11, 2001, that happened, and I slipped into it was dark. It got real dark for me. You know, I stood on my building, and I saw the second plane hit with my naked eye. Like, me and my cousin, we watched the buildings drop, you know, and for like 2 weeks after that happened, like the wind given on any given Sunday, and depending on which way the wind would shift, I could smell the burning flesh still in the air.
Yeah, that it was
like, fucked me up bad, bro.
I was in Astoria. I watched the same thing in Astoria from my roof, and that metal smell, burning smell. Man.
It lasted for weeks.
It
was also the flesh.
Yeah.
That's what I know what burning flesh smells like, man. I was just like, this is so. Anyway, Needless to say, I relapsed. let's just get that out there. So you know,
what was your thing, man?
Cocaine, man. You know what I mean? Coke and alcohol.
Yeah.
So I relapsed and I struggled for all of 2001. I mean, for most of 2000, you know, after 9/11. And on October, I was sitting in my apartment with my cousin and one of my homeboys, man. And, you know, we was getting high, and the setting would be you turn the TV on, but you mute it. And then you blast the music,
sure.
Right? And
that's get everything how, that's going.
How, that's, yeah, that's how you do it, right? So,
and then you're talking. You're talking too.
Yeah, we're talking shit. Yeah, exactly. So I think we're playing chess. You know, I get high, play chess, right? Talk shit. You know. So the TV was on, and I had it on HBO, Mark, and I looked at the screen, and it was an episode of Sopranos that I was in. So I looked up, I was like, I had this like out of body experience. I was like, what the fuck? I said, and then I looked what I was doing. I said, man, there's something wrong with this picture. And so I asked my mom's, man, I said, yo, mom, I said, I said, I don't know if I could do this no more. I said, I got this. I said, I feel like I should give this Hollywood shit one more shot. And she said, what you need? I said, I need you to lend me some money because I got to reinvent my package, because I've been up the scene for 2 years, and now they doing this new thing called a reel. You got to put a reel together, and I got to do new headshots, blah, 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 blah. So I got to hire people, mom. And she said, all right. She lent me the money, and this was in late October, early November. I did everything, and
you didn't spend it on drugs. That's good.
Not all of it. Hey, y'all, keep it real, right?
Yeah.
Not all of it.
Yeah.
But I got what I needed to get done. And then I gave them out. I had a hit list of 10 names of people who I knew in the business that if I had any shot, I could get it from them. And, you know, Queen Latifah and Shakim Kapoor, Jimmy Roseman, Jackie Brown Carmen. I remember it was 10 names. And I sent out the new package. And I said, you know what? It's Christmas and they're going to look at it. They're going to see that I'm back on the block and my phone's going to be ringing off the hook. Give it the second, third week in January. It's going to be major, right? here we are, February. Ain't nothing happening. And my mom was like, where the fuck did you, what did you do with my money?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, man. So, you know, I slipped into a depression, man. You know, like for real. Like, you know, I had to go see a doctor and he prescribed me like Paxil. And I'm sitting there smoking weed and taking Paxil, wondering why I don't feel better, right? Like, what the fuck? And that was in February. And then in March, my mother called me, man. She's like, yo, come downstairs. There's a fax for you. And I went and I got the fax. And you know what it was, Mark?
It was David Simon.
It was the breakdown. Yes, it was. It was Alexa Fogle.
Uh-huh.
And it was the breakdown for Omar Devone Little. And that's when I knew this is real. This is real. Like, I got this. This is it. I knew
they offered it to you.
Well, no, I had to audition.
Yeah,
I had to audition. But once I got it, I'm saying, you know, I went in her office. She auditioned me. I think 3 days later, she called me telling me to be on the next Amtrak and report to Baltimore. Like, I was on the set for like a week before I even met David. Like, I had to like jump right in head first, and I never looked back, bro.
Thank God you've done the research.
Ah, yeah, right? Yeah, you joke, but that's for real.
Yeah.
I poured a lot of my pain into the character of Omar, man. A lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a great character. It was one of the, you know, the best characters that whole thing. I mean, I remember, like, I didn't watch it in real time. I watched it all at once. So, like, I had watched it a couple years after the fact, but I was in New York and I was doing a radio gig. And I just would watch 3 or 4 episodes a day like I was on drugs, man. It was like The Wire was my drug. I would binge. I would do like 4 or 5 episodes a day, and I'd feel fucked up after. But your character was like, every time Omar came on, you're like, ah, there's fucking Omar, man. You're always happy.
I'm going to tell you a secret, though.
Yeah.
You want to know what the best character on that show was, hands down?
Yeah.
It was the city of Baltimore.
Yes.
I promise you, like, that city permeates. I can't. You had to be on those streets. Like, you know, we shot a lot of location.
Yeah.
Why it wasn't a cushy set type of a gig. We was in them streets, bro. And I got to know the people. I got to see the culture. I got to feel the streets.
Yeah.
You know, and when I tell you, that city is one of the most beautiful cities, one of the most beautiful gems in this country, and we don't know it. But Baltimore, the city of Baltimore, is the number one character. The people and the energy and the spirit of that city is the number one character on The Wire.
And Simon loves that city. I mean, so like he
still lives there. Born and bred, still there.
Yeah. I interviewed that guy. He's a smart guy.
Yeah, crazy motherfucker. That's my big bro.
Yeah, I thought, obviously, I'm not alone in thinking that was an amazing show, but it's just all the performances were deep, man. You know, and I just work with Andre. I'm friends with Andre.
Royal?
Yeah.
Come on, man.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
We just did a movie a month ago.
I know what it is. Me and him, we stay in contact, man. I know exactly which parts you're talking about.
Oh, my God.
I can't remember the name, but I know.
To Leslie, it's called. Is the name.
Bingo.
Yeah. But I can't imagine you two getting together. I would have to sit that one out and just to watch you guys talk.
We've been talking about that. Me, him, and Sonya.
Yeah. Well,
Sonya and I have been talking about developing something. Sonya Song, who played Kima Greggs.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah, us three, we're the Three Musketeers. And she and I, we both have full working on a knowledge that you must know now too. Andre Royal was special.
Yes.
He different.
Yeah.
He ain't far from regular. Like we all cute. All of us is cute. But Andre Royal was special. And like if you know him, then you know what I'm talking about. I ain't got time to go into why we know this, but you and I know why I say he's special.
He'll go there, man.
So, Dre different, bro.
Yeah.
He says he says with such vernacular and such effortlessness what most of us are thinking, and it's not tacky, it's not offensive. He just has this way of spitting that shit that's on all of our minds, but none of us have the balls to say, and he does it with such a freedom that you just have to, you'd be like, you just don't, like, what do you do? It's like, anyway.
Yeah, no, he's got, there's a real kind of honest vulnerability there that he speaks from.
Perfect, yes.
Right?
Yes.
And you just got to be like, what the fuck?
You got to love him. You got to love him.
That's true.
You have to love him, man.
Yeah.
And, you know, or you hate him, but you ain't going to like him. You're
right.
Either going to love him or you're going to hate him.
If you hate him, you got problems.
You got fucking problems, my dude. So we've been working on a project that will highlight Dre, man. And if I could be a it's funny you said it, because Sonya and I, we talk about that often. We got to create something for our brother, because that's how much we feel he's just that special to us.
Yeah, and I think also it's a weird place for him because like he should be in everything, but I don't know how much is coming to him, and I don't know if people really know how to use him, you know, because if they he'd be working.
Come on, man, you think you already know what that is? That's about that's a whole other conversation that, you know, I'm not going to go down that road right now, because you know I'm tired of waiting for I'm at the point now where it's time for me to build my own table. It's time for us to build our own table.
Sure.
You know,
you're going to start a production company?
That's already done. It's called Free Dome Productions.
Oh,
Dome
good.
Peace, Free Your Dome, Free Dome Productions. And we out of here, we know we're housed in the Navy Yard here in Brooklyn. And that ship has sailed. You know, and this pandemic has humbled us.
Yeah.
And it has leveled the playing field massively. And if it's ever time to shoot your shot, I believe it's now.
Yeah.
So, you're right. They don't know what to do with him. They barely know what the fuck to do with me. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's time for us to lift each other up.
Now,
man.
Do you ever think about, theater anymore?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Me and my brother, the same gentleman that introduced me to theater, Ray Thomas from Philadelphia. Yeah. He and I was talking the other day, man, and, you know, we're working on this idea about a traveling theater, like just take it, you know, we come with a story and travel. The idea of traveling theater and taking it to like neighborhoods that normally would not be exposed to a play, you know, and what that would look like.
Well, someday when we can go back outside, we can.
I can't congregate right now, but you know, we're definitely talking about that, man.
It must have been interesting, like La Mama, because like that's some weird shit sometimes.
And you know what? What's I love about theater too? There's no mistakes. There's no cut and action. It forces us to use everything.
Yeah.
You got to stay in the moment. It forces me to stay in the moment. Like, I remember when I first started coming around, because of my theater training, I memorized everybody's lines. In fact, I would only write my lines and not memorize them. I would just write them down, but I would memorize your lines, the other actors' lines, because I needed to stay in that moment. And what I did with my dialogue, I would tell myself, well, Mike, if I understand the world and what the other characters are saying and where they're coming from, my lines will be common sense. It'll be logic. I don't have to remember my line. It'll come to me because it's logic.
Oh, and then then you know the intention. You know,
bingo,
like, right?
Bingo. And so theater taught me that, and theater also taught me to know the intention. If you switched it up, because another thing about Andre Royal, he also comes from the theater background, same circuit that I was running in. Dre was running and we didn't know each other at the time.
Yeah.
We actually did the same play and didn't know each other at the time with Yolanda Ross. We played three different men in her life and she was like marrying with blah blah blah. So Dre was notorious for switching it up. If the line was like, I gotta go home and walk my dog, Dre'd be like, I gotta go feed my cat.
Yeah.
And you gotta theater taught me, no matter how many times how many nights we do it, if I mess around and stop listening to you and waiting for you to shut up so I can say my line, I could get tricked with an actor like Andre, who might, you know, he might throw you a nugget, and if you're not in a position to catch it, you're going to trip. It'll knock you in the head because you're so. Theater taught me those things, man.
Yeah. You got to listen.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So you feel better. Now, when you did The Wire, were you high?
I didn't get high the whole first season of The Wire. I had wanted to make such a good impression on David and Nina and Ed. I decided, I stopped smoking weed. I wasn't getting high, nothing. And ironically, I picked up cigarettes. I said, cigarettes don't get me high. And it'll feed my oral fixation.
That's a tough one.
I went to clothes, the Jarums.
Yeah.
I started there, And so the whole first season, I didn't get high. And then, they made me a series regular on season two.
Yeah.
And, as we all know, season two is about the docs. So what happened again? My idle mind became the devil's workshop. I'm in Baltimore. I'm already partying, going to clubs and things of that nature. And I have all this time on my hands. I don't have the responsibility you can't get fucked up because you got to be to work tomorrow. There were like weeks, a week or days, chunks of time in between.
So you got to play some chess.
And I ended up picking up in season two. I really, man, the cast of The Wire, Wendell Pierce, Sonya, Andre.
Wendell's the best.
Seth Gilliam, Dom Lombardozzi. These men and women, man, they would come grab me up. They never let me slip too far between the cracks, man. And we became a family. They became my family on season two, I should say. And that still holds true to this day.
That's beautiful. And in terms of influences, to have Andre on one side and Wendell on the other, you got the full spectrum, man. You know, you got the raw honesty and then you got the thinky stuff. You know what I mean?
Wendell is like an oracle.
Yeah.
A lot of heart, and he got a lot of fight in him. Don't let those reading glasses and that three-piece suit fool you with that necktie. Wendell will fuck you up. And he comes, that's a New Orleans dude. Through and through, man, and he's educated.
Yeah.
And he's not afraid,
yeah.
You know, and you know, like he drops jewels. Like he's full of wisdom. Like early on in the career, man, Wendell sat me down, forget what we was talking about, but he said, you know what, Michael? He said, this business is about the work you do, the people you meet, and the relationships that you build. And I never forgot that.
Yeah.
It kept me humble. It kept me focused on what's important about being in this land of make-believe that we live in.
Yeah, yeah.
Kept me. Yeah, so that's the kind of thing that Wendell, but he'll be right beside you at the bar throwing him back. He has, you know, a lot of people don't know Wendell. If you look at him and you perceive him a certain way, and you miss the party. You will miss the party weren't looking at his suit and tie.
Yeah, I've talked to him. He's a great guy. So when you did the Boardwalk Empire, man, how do you feel about that time travel business? You like going to different time?
You know, I was talking to a good friend of mine, and he kind of hit me, you know, pulled my attention to what you just said.
Yeah.
Yes, the answer first off is yes. I do love going back in time. I decided to use those stories, whether it was Chucky White on Boardwalk Empire or Jack G in Bessie opposite Queen Latifah, or if it was Montrose Freeman in Lovecraft Country. There is something that my friend Gano, he was telling me, he said, yo, Mike, he said, have you noticed the ancestors keep bringing you back, using you to tell their story? And it's not just all over the place. I'm always being asked to go to the 1920s, the era that my father was born in.
Huh.
And my good friend, like I said, we was talking, he was like, you know, we do, you know, I work with my ancestors, man. I acknowledge them on a daily basis. And he hit me to that just recently. So yes, I do. I also take the opportunity to go back in time and tell the stories of my ancestors. I also wear that just as much with a badge of honor and a huge responsibility to me as well.
Is your folks still around?
My father's deceased. My mom's still alive, man. She just made 93 this past December. Still swinging that cane trying to knock me out. Come here, bro. I'll knock you out. All right, Mom.
She lived close by?
Nah, man, we got her out of state. You know, we got her out of New York. You know, 93, she nice. Did her bit. I'm 50 some odd years in the projects. You know, she managed to save her. And let me go on record. She bought her own house, cash, from that daycare. You know, and man, it took some nudging because she was so comfortable. You know, 50 some, almost 60 years in one apartment, in one building, in one community. Wow. And
that's New York, man.
Yeah, in Brooklyn, right, yeah. In Vanderveer. And, you know, like around 70, after her 75th birthday, man, we took some nudging, but she said, what the hell, okay, I'll go. So she's out of state now, but she's happy. Doing fine. She's happy, very right. happy.
And you're happy?
Yes, I am, man. I'm grateful. You already know.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm grateful. I ain't got nothing to complain about, man. We here.
Yeah, and you're cooking. You got Rachel Ray.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but Rachel Ray, she cut out of miss already for this morning. I'll catch her recipe tomorrow.
Have you ever met her?
Yes, actually I did, man. She interviewed me when I was doing this show called Happen Leonard.
Did she know you were such a big fan?
Well, after the show went off, yeah, she found out because I was not about to leave. I said, yo, Rachel. I said, hey yo, I said, you know. There's no way I'm leaving this studio without you making me a hamburger. you gotta make me the special Rachel Ray burger. Cause I don't, you know, with the three different kinds of meats, I need that in my life. She looked at me and she chuckled. She's like, this motherfucker. But she went to the set kitchen because there's a real kitchen on that set.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's all real. Yeah. She went in the back and 20 minutes later, man, I had an authentic, you know, Rachel Ray cheeseburger. I could have died and went to heaven.
Well, I'm glad that happened for you. Yeah, right. All right, man, it was good talking to you, and I love the movie. I love your work, and You know, this is like going to a meeting. I feel better.
Thank you, Mark. Same here, brother. Thank you, man.
Okay, pal. Take it easy. Yeah,
bye, man.
That's it. That's our show. The movie is Body Brokers, and that's available now to buy or rent on on-demand platforms like iTunes, Prime Video, and more. Let's play some guitar. Boomer lives, Monkey and La Fonda and Cat Angels everywhere. 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 Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.